You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume Number 4, by Rudolf Steiner, the Michael Wilson 150th Anniversary Translation of The Philosophy of Freedom, The Basis for a Modern World Conception. This is the beginning of the first section, Knowledge of Freedom, Chapter 1, entitled Conscious Human Action. Is the human being, in his thinking and acting, spiritually free? Or is he compelled by the iron necessity of purely natural law? There are few questions upon which so much sagacity has been brought to bear. The idea of the freedom of the human will has found enthusiastic supporters and stubborn opponents in plenty. There are those who, in their moral fervor, label anyone an individual of limited intelligence, who can deny so patent a fact as freedom. Opposed to them are others who regard it as the acme of unscientific thinking for anyone to believe that the uniformity of natural law is broken in the sphere of human action and thinking. One and the same thing is thus proclaimed, now as the most precious possession of humanity, now as its most fatal illusion. Infinite subtlety has been employed to explain how human freedom can be consistent with the laws working in nature, of which man, after all, is a part. No less is the trouble to which others have gone to explain how such a delusion as this could have arisen. Yet we are dealing here with one of the most important questions for life, religion, conduct, science, must be felt by anyone who includes any degree of thoroughness at all in his makeup. It is one of the sad signs of the superficiality of present-day thought that a book which attempts to develop a new faith out of the results of recent scientific research, has nothing more to say on this question than these words, quote, "With the question of the freedom of the human will, we are not concerned. The alleged freedom of indifferent choice has been recognized as an empty illusion by every philosophy worthy of the name. The moral valuation of human action and character remains untouched by this problem. It is not because I consider that the book in which it occurs has any special importance that I quote this passage, but because it seems to me to express the view to which the thinking of most of our contemporaries manages to rise in this matter. Everyone who claims to have grown beyond the kindergarten stage of science appears to know nowadays that freedom cannot consist in choosing, at one's pleasure, one or other of two possible courses of action. There is always, so we are told, a perfectly definite reason why, out of several possible actions, we carry out just one and no other. This seems obvious. Nevertheless, down to the present day, the main attacks of the opponents of freedom are directed only against freedom of choice. Even Herbert Spencer, whose doctrines are gaining ground daily, says, quote, "that everyone is at liberty to desire or not to desire, which is the real proposition involved in the dogma of free will, is negatived as much by the analysis of consciousness as by the contents of the preceding chapter." From The Principles of Psychology, 1855, German edition, 1882, Part 4, Chapter 9, Paragraph 219, end of quote. Others, too, start from the same point of view in combating the concept of free will. The germs of all the relevant arguments are to be found as early as Spinoza. All that he brought forward in clear and simple language against the idea of freedom has since been repeated times without number, but as a rule enveloped in the most hair-splitting theoretical doctrines, so that it is difficult to recognize the straightforward train of thought, which is all that matters. Spinoza writes in a letter of October or November 1674, quote, "I call a thing free, which exists and acts from the pure necessity of its nature. And I call that unfree, of which the being and action are precisely and fixedly determined by something else. Thus, for example, God, though necessary, is free, because he exists only through the necessity of his own nature. Similarly, God cognizes himself and all else freely, because it follows solely from the necessity of his nature that he cognizes all. You see, therefore, that for me freedom consists not in free decision, but in free necessity. But let us come down to created things, which are all determined by external causes to exist, and to act in a fixed and definite manner. To perceive this more clearly, let us imagine a perfectly simple case. A stone, for example, receives from an external cause acting upon it a certain quantity of motion, by reason of which it necessarily continues to move after the impact of the external cause has ceased. The continued motion of the stone is due to compulsion, not to the necessity of its own nature, because it requires to be defined by the thrust of an external cause. What is true here for the stone is true also for every other particular thing, however complicated and many-sided it may be. Namely, that everything is necessarily determined by external causes to exist and to act in a fixed and definite manner. Now, please, suppose that this stone, during its motion, thinks and knows that it is striving to the best of its ability to continue in motion. This stone, which is conscious only of its striving and is by no means indifferent, will believe that it is absolutely free and that it continues in motion for no other reason than its own will to continue. But this is just the human freedom that everybody claims to possess, and which consists in nothing but this, that men are conscious of their desires, but ignorant of the causes by which they are determined. Thus the child believes that he desires milk of his own free will. The angry boy regards his desire for vengeance as free, and the coward his desire for flight. Again, the drunken man believes that he says of his own free will what, sober again, he would fain have left unsaid. And as this prejudice is innate in all men, it is difficult to free oneself from it. For although experience teaches us often enough that man least of all can temper his desires, and that moved by conflicting passions, he sees the better and pursues the worse, yet he considers himself free, because there are some things which he desires less strongly, and some desires which he can easily inhibit through the recollection of something else which it is often possible to recall." Close quote. Because this view is so clearly and definitely expressed, it is easy to detect the fundamental error that it contains. The same necessity by which a stone makes a definite movement as the result of an impact is said to compel a man to carry out an action when impelled thereto by any reason. It is only because man is conscious of his action that he thinks himself to be its originator. But in doing so, he overlooks the fact that he is driven by a cause which he cannot help obeying. The error in this train of thought is soon discovered. Spinoza and all who think like him overlook the fact that man not only is conscious of his action, but also may become conscious of the causes which guide him. Nobody will deny that the child is unfree when he desires milk, or the drunken man when he says things which he later regrets. Neither knows anything of the causes working in the depths of their organisms, which exercise irresistible control over them. But is it justifiable to lump together actions of this kind with those in which a man is conscious, not only of his actions, but also of the reasons which cause him to act? Are the actions of men really all of one kind? Should the act of a soldier on the field of battle, of the scientific researcher in his laboratory, of the statesman in the most complicated diplomatic negotiations be placed, scientifically, on the same level with that of the child when it desires milk? It is no doubt true that it is best to seek the solution of a problem where the conditions are simplest. But inability to discriminate has before now caused endless confusion. There is, after all, a profound difference between knowing why I am acting and not knowing it. At first sight, this seems a self-evident truth, and yet the opponents of freedom never ask themselves whether a motive of action, which I recognize and see through, is to be regarded as compulsory for me, in the same sense as the organic process which causes the child to cry for milk. Edward von Hartmann asserts that the human will depends on two chief factors, the motives and the character. And footnote, this is from Phänomenologie des Sittlichen Bewusstseins, page 451, by Edward von Hartmann, end of footnote. If one regards people as all alike, or at any rate the differences between them as negligible, then their will appears to be determined from without, that is to say, by the circumstances which come to meet them. But if one bears in mind that a person adopts an idea or mental picture as the motive of his action only if his character is such that this mental picture arouses a desire in him, then he appears as determined from within and not from without. Now, because in accordance with his character, a person must first adopt as a motive a mental picture given to him from without, he believes he is free, that is, independent of external impulses. The truth, however, according to Edward von Hartmann, is that, quote, even though we ourselves first adopt a mental picture as a motive, we do so not arbitrarily, but according to the necessity of our characterological disposition. That is, we are anything but free. Close quote. Here again, the difference between motives which I allow to influence me only after I have permeated them with my consciousness, and those which I follow without any clear knowledge of them, is absolutely ignored. This leads us straight to the standpoint from which the subject will be considered here. Have we any right to consider the question of the freedom of the will by itself at all? And if not, with what other question must it necessarily be connected? if there is a difference between a conscious motive of action and an unconscious urge, then the conscious motive will result in an action which must be judged differently from one that springs from blind impulse. Hence, our first question will concern this difference. And on the result of this inquiry will depend what attitude we shall have to take toward the question of freedom proper. What does it mean to have knowledge of the reasons for one's action? Too little attention has been paid to this question, because, unfortunately, we have torn into two what is really an inseparable whole, man. We have distinguished between the knower and the doer, and have left out of account precisely the one who matters most of all, the knowing doer. It is said that man is free when he is controlled only by his reason and not by his animal passions. Or, again, that to be free means to be able to determine one's life and action by purposes and deliberate decisions. Nothing is gained by assertions of this sort. For the question is just whether reason, purposes, and decisions exercise the same kind of compulsion over a man as his animal passions. If without my cooperation, a rational decision emerges in me with the same necessity with which hunger and thirst arise, then I must needs obey it, and my freedom is an illusion. Another form of expression runs, to be free does not mean to be able to want as one wills, but to be able to do as one wills. This thought has been expressed with great clearness by the poet-philosopher Robert Hamerling. Quote, man can certainly do as he wills, but he cannot want as he wills, because his wanting is determined by motives. He cannot want as he wills? Let us consider these phrases more closely. Have they any intelligible meaning? Freedom of will would then mean being able to want without ground, without motive. But what does wanting mean, if not to have grounds for doing or trying to do this rather than that? To want something without ground or motive would be to want something without wanting it. The concept of wanting cannot be divorced from the concept of motive. Without a determining motive, the will is an empty faculty. Only through the motive does it become active and real. It is, therefore, quite true that the human will is not free, in quotes, inasmuch as its direction is always determined by the strongest motive. But on the other hand, it must be admitted that it is absurd, in contrast with this unfreedom, to speak of a conceivable freedom of the will, which would consist in being able to want what one does not want. Close quote. And that is from Atomistik des Willens, volume 2, page 213, forward by Robert Hamerling, and a footnote. Here again, only motives in general are mentioned, without taking into account the difference between unconscious and conscious motives. If a motive affects me, and I am compelled to act on it, because it proves to be the strongest of its kind, then the thought of freedom ceases to have any meaning. How should it matter to me whether I can do a thing or not if I am forced by the motive to do it? The primary question is not whether I can do a thing or not when a motive has worked upon me, but whether there are any motives except such as impel me with absolute necessity. If I am compelled to want something, then I may well be absolutely indifferent as to whether I can also do it. And if through my character, or through circumstances prevailing in my environment, a motive is forced on me, which to my thinking is unreasonable, then I should even have to be glad if I could not do what I want. The question is not whether I can carry out a decision once made, but how the decision comes about within me. What distinguishes man from all other organic beings arises from his rational thinking. Activity he has in common with other organisms. Nothing is gained by seeking analogies in the animal world to clarify the concept of freedom as applied to the actions of human beings. Modern science loves such analogies. When scientists have succeeded in finding among animals something similar to human behavior, they believe they have touched on the most important question of the science of man. To what misunderstandings this view leads is seen, for example, in the book titled The Illusion of Free Will by Paul Ray, where the following remark on freedom appears. Quote, "It is easy to explain why the movement of a stone seems to us necessary, while the volition of a donkey does not. The causes which set the stone in motion are external and visible, while the causes which determine the donkey's volition are internal and invisible. Between us and the place of their activity, there is the skull of the ass. The determining causes are not visible, and therefore thought to be non-existent. The volition, it is explained, is indeed the cause of the donkey's turning round, but is itself unconditioned. It is an absolute beginning." Close quote. Here again, human actions in which there is a consciousness of the motives are simply ignored. For Ray declares that, quote, "between us and the place of their activity, there is the skull of the ass," close quote. To judge from these words, it has not dawned on Ray that there are actions, not indeed of the ass, but of human beings, in which, between us and the action, lies the motive that has become conscious. Ray demonstrates his blindness once again a few pages further on when he says, quote, "We do not perceive the causes by which our will is determined. Hence we think it is not causally determined at all." Close quote. But enough of examples which prove that many argue against freedom without knowing in the least what freedom is. That an action of which the agent does not know why he performs it cannot be free goes without saying. But what about an action for which the reasons are known? This leads us to the question of the origin and meaning of thinking. For without the recognition of the thinking activity of the soul, it is impossible to form a concept of knowledge about anything, and therefore of knowledge about an action. When we know what thinking in general means, it will be easy to get clear about the role that thinking plays in human action. As Hegel rightly says, quote, "It is thinking that turns the soul, which the animals also possess, into spirit," close quote. Hence it will also be thinking that gives to human action its characteristic stamp. On no account should it be said that all our action springs only from the sober deliberations of our reason. I am very far from calling human, in the highest sense, only those actions that proceed from abstract judgment. But as soon as our conduct rises above the sphere of the satisfaction of purely animal desires, our motives are always permeated by thoughts. Love, pity, and patriotism are driving forces for actions which cannot be analyzed away into cold concepts of the intellect. It is said that here the heart and the mood of the soul hold sway, no doubt. But the heart and the mood of the soul do not create the motives. They presuppose them and let them enter. Pity enters my heart when the mental picture of a person who arouses pity appears in my consciousness. The way to the heart is through the head. Love is no exception. Whenever it is not merely the expression of bare sexual instinct, it depends on the mental picture we form of the loved one. And the more idealistic these mental pictures are, just so much the more blessed is our love. Here, too, thought is the father of feeling. It is said that love makes us blind to the failings of the loved one, but this can be expressed the other way round, namely that it is just for the good qualities that love opens the eyes. Many pass by these good qualities without noticing them. One, however, perceives them, and just because he does, love awakens in his soul. What else has he done but made a mental picture of what hundreds have failed to see? Love is not theirs because they lack the mental picture. However we approach the matter, it becomes more and more clear that the question of the nature of human action presupposes that of the origin of thinking. I shall therefore turn next to this question. The end of chapter 1.